Do we have peace in the Middle East? Israel and Hezbollah are reportedly this close to having a ceasefire deal. Meanwhile, there are pretty significant developments in Russia's invasion of Ukraine, but not ones that are going to lead to peace in the long term. And the world holds its breath as America prepares for its presidential election. We have all this and more on today's Trumpet World. Welcome back to Trumpet World. We've taken a bit of a break, and now we've got a lot to catch up on. First, we'll turn to Andrew Miller to get the latest on the U.S. presidential election.
America's heading into what's shaping up to be its most contentious presidential election in its history. The election's coming up this Tuesday, and those who've been through election cycles before know that this is normally the stage of election where political parties tone back on some of the heated rhetoric they use to stir up their base during the primary season, and really try to reach out to moderate, independent, and undecided voters, making their last pitch for why you should vote for their candidate.
So not a time to refer to political opponents as garbage, normally, is what you're telling me.
This is not normally the stage of the election where you're going to refer to political opponents as garbage or really try to offend undecided voters in some dramatic way. That type of rhetoric is normally reserved for the primary season. So it's kind of unexpected now that, like you said, Biden did actually come out and refer to Trump supporters as garbage. So pretty much alienating the entire conservative side of the political spectrum and a number of undecided voters. It's also not normally the time where you'd refer to Trump as Adolf Hitler, which a number of surprisingly prominent Democrats have done in this last week. Actually, there was one news commentator who even made the point that it's unusual. It's like this type of like Trump as Hitler comparison is something that's not necessarily unprecedented in the primary season, but a really strange comparison to make this late in the election. Now, Trump's former chief of staff, John Kelly, who parted with Trump on bad terms as kind of a disgruntled employee, hasn't had much good to say. He recently gave an interview for some background, alleging that he had some conversation with Trump years ago where Trump said that Hitler did some good things and he wished that he had generals who were more like Hitler's. And so whether Trump said those things or not, you have to take his word for. And the quotes are basically meaningless out of context. Even the most anti-fascist historian will usually say that Hitler made the trains run on time, which everyone referred to as a good thing. And so these comments, like I said, there's no video clip, so we don't know exactly what it said.
And I think there are others there that dispute them, aren't there?
Trump claims that he never said any of the
right. It's like that, very much a he said, she said. We don't know.
So we don't know what Trump said in this case, but that hasn't stopped the editor-in-chief of The Atlantic, which is a pretty major newspaper here in the United States, from running an entire editorial on Trump wants American generals to be more like Nazis. Nor has it stopped the actual Democratic presidential candidate, Kamala Harris, from giving a several minute press conference addressing this Trump as Hitler comparison and explicitly endorsing that Trump is a fascist. I actually have that video clip here, so we can actually listen directly to Harris as to what she thinks happened during this Trump and Hitler conversation.
So yesterday we learned that Donald Trump's former chief of staff, John Kelly, a retired four-star general, confirmed that while Donald Trump was president, he said he wanted generals like Adolf Hitler had. Donald Trump said that because he does not want a military that is loyal to the United States Constitution. He wants a military that is loyal to him.
Yeah, so there you have it right there. That's Kamala Harris, just about a week before the election, stating her dogmatic opinion that Trump is a fascist who wants generals who are more loyal to him than to the U.S. Constitution. So that's her closing pitch before the election, is vote for me because Donald Trump is literally a Nazi. And like I mentioned before, this is not something that's going to likely help undecided voters in Pennsylvania decide that Harris is the most mentally stable person who needs to be running the United States. Yet they made the case anyway. And you might argue that she is just that unhinged from reality. But Lee Smith, he's one of the better investigative journalists in the United States, and someone who's been on the Trumpet Daily radio program before, he actually wrote a really interesting article this week titled, "Is the Left Preparing for War If Trump Wins?" Which has an interesting take. He says here that the purpose of the Hitler narrative is not to alter the electoral preferences of left-wing media audiences already solidly in the anti-Trump column, but rather to justify taking extreme measures against the Republican candidate and the American First Movement and ensure that the bulk of the military insults the anti-Trump plot. So basically saying that this type of extreme rhetoric so close to the election isn't designed to change anyone's opinion about who to vote for. The people who think Trump is Hitler weren't going to vote for Trump anyway. The people who were undecided about Trump are unlikely to side against him just because the other side said he's Adolf Hitler. So this isn't going to shift any votes. He said, but what it might do is if the election's close, or if there's some legal disputes about fraudulent ballots or illegal aliens in Pennsylvania voting in this election, or any sort of ambiguity that puts the election into doubt, which is likely. A lot of the states, they're accepting mail-in ballots till up to a week after the election. There's already Supreme Court cases where people going back and forth over whether you can purge illegal immigrants from the ballot. So it's likely that there's going to be some question marks when you wake up on November 6th. So it's not, like I said, I think Lee Smith makes a good point there, that it's not really going to shift anyone's votes. But if the vote is close anyway, this is basically what Peter Strzok would have called an insurance policy. You know, remember back in 2016, even before the election happened, they were already concocting the Trump-Russia collusion hoax as an insurance policy, that in case Trump wins, we can use this Trump-Russia collusion hoax to try to impeach him or do other things to undermine his incoming administration. Lee Smith is saying that this whole Trump is Hitler thing is really looks like it's the 2024 version of the insurance policy. Harris, the fact that she's not reaching out to independent voters means that it indicates to us that she thinks it's likely that Trump could win this election. And they're already looking for an insurance policy. It's like, well, how do we undermine an incoming Trump administration? And the plan seems to be is like, well, just double down on the narrative that Trump is a fascist dictator and try to like radicalize the Democratic base to be like, if Trump is literally Hitler, then almost any move you take against him is thereby justified. Since Hitler was one of the most reprehensible people in human history, if you take the accusation literally, you can justify riots, you can justify revolts, you can justify legal action to try to challenge the election.
So obviously, America's election, this is something of great concern to the entire world. It's going to affect the whole world. I saw a poll this morning showing that Western Europe was overwhelmingly in favor of Kamala Harris. Eastern Europe was merely strongly in favor of Kamala Harris. Your forecast, at least in terms of, you know, what we can see in polls and things like that, is a Donald Trump victory, but a contested victory.
Yeah, I think that's that sounds absolutely right. It's even looking at some indications like U.S. Treasury bonds, the yield on a U.S. Treasury bond has kind of unexpectedly ticked up about 0.5% in the past month. And the explanation I've seen from financial analysts is that Wall Street investors think that Donald Trump would be better for the U.S. economy. And not just Wall Street investors, but investors around the world. So the people who get rich off predicting things like this seem pretty confident that the Republicans are going to win, and financial markets are already adjusting to affect that reality. So they're a very good indication of a Trump win. But like I said, if you look at the polls, the swing states are so close that it'll probably be a contested victory. We also have some indication of Bible prophecy for that. Our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, in his book, America Under Attack, repeatedly quotes 2 Kings 14, verses 26 through 28, that talks about an end-time antitype of King Jeroboam II, saving Israel from being blotted out and warring to recover something that was stolen from him. But the prophecy seems pretty clear that there is some sort of warring that goes on with the election. And we're already seeing that on the legal front in some case of, like I said, like some states, Virginia and Georgia come to mind, are trying to purge a few thousand illegal voters who snuck their way onto the ballots. The Biden administration is suing them for trying to kick those illegals off the ballots. And the Supreme Court's already intervening. I think they just issued a stay saying that they can continue purging it, but they're going to have to look at it more closely. So there already is some legal warfare going on simultaneously with the election over whether illegals can vote or not, even though that seems like it should be kind of a no-brainer.
So if you are living overseas and you are a little bit fed up of U.S. election news and you're looking forward to it going away after Tuesday, after seemingly a campaign that has lasted 4 years, probably not going to happen is what you're saying. And we could still see all of this dragging on for some time.
Oh, yeah. I expect you're going to be hearing accusations of one side or from one side or another about a stolen election until at least January and maybe a little bit after that.
I think that does show a lot about the decline of the political system in the United States, even, you know, societal problems, not unique to the United States, of course, where it's like, well, we can't just have a normal election anymore. We can't sit down and vote. And, you know, the solution isn't necessarily everyone just comes together and sings Kumbaya and it's, you know, if there is actual election stealing going on, well, that does need to be uncovered and exposed and things. It's not just a case of where, well, we all need to get on with each other better. But it does show a sickness that's there in American society, a sickness that is present in a lot of other societies. When you see division just reaching that violent state. Now, you watch Anglo-America. That's not just the United States. You have some other news stories that have gone on from some of the political systems in the rest of the English-speaking world as well, I believe.
Yeah, yeah. It's good to talk about the other English-speaking nations settled by the British Empire over the decades. I actually just got back about a week ago from Fiji, and was talking with several people down there about just the level of Chinese investment in the Fijian military and in the Fijian tourist industry and in Fijian politics and just China's efforts to expand its influence into the Pacific Ocean. China also recently lost an intercontinental ballistic missile into the Pacific, a test launch, just kind of proof of concept that they do have the ability to hit targets quite far off their shore if they need to, which has the English-speaking nation of Australia quite worried. And they announced this week that they're going to be really upping their budget and spending on their own Australian missile programs just to be able to counter the rising threat of China in that South Pacific arena.
Well, thank you for that, Andrew. Russia is, of course, another place where people are always saying regime change is on the brink, especially every time there is negative news about Russian President Vladimir Putin. I guess those critics are probably a bit quieter than ever this week, as I think Jeremiah has some pretty significant victories for Mr. Putin to talk to us about.
Yes, that's right. The big story that I wanted to talk about is that Russian President Vladimir Putin is making gains in retaking former Soviet territory. This week was a big one for this in several different former Soviet nations. And the most significant part of it happened, unsurprisingly, in Ukraine. Russia has, of course, been fighting a full-scale war there for more than 2.5 years now, fighting to conquer as much of Ukraine as possible. And it has been grueling and glacially paced for most of the last year. But this week, Russia made some significant progress. They captured the eastern Ukrainian town of Selidov and also the town of Hirnik. And when you add up the territory of these towns and the other land that Russia has recently conquered over the last few days, it comes out to more than 75 square miles. And that means Russia is now advancing in eastern Ukraine at its fastest pace in at least a year. North Korea is now in the war as well, sending thousands of troops to fight alongside the Russians. And it looks like those North Koreans are being sent mostly to Kursk, Russia. That's the region of Western Russia that Ukraine is occupying. And sending the North Koreans there appears to have freed up Russian forces to focus more on eastern Ukraine. And that may have factored into this faster advance that we're now seeing from Russia. But in either case, the Russians are advancing in Ukraine and putting more of its territory under Putin's control. But Ukraine was not the only former Soviet nation where Putin made gains this week. He also had a significant victory in the former Soviet nation of Georgia. This was not a military victory, but a political one. There's a political party there called Georgian Dream, which Putin, he essentially owns this party at this point. It's a party led by a man who Putin made rich. The name of this party should really be changed to Russian Dream at this point. And the overwhelming majority of the Georgian people are staunchly against it. But this week, Putin's agents in Georgia managed to rig elections to give Georgian Dream a big victory. Right now, the Georgian people are just up in arms about this. They're protesting out in the streets, you know, against what was clearly a stolen election. But Putin's grip on Georgia is getting tighter and tighter, so it's hard to see how anything significant could come from these protests. And then it's a somewhat similar situation in the former Soviet nation of Moldova. Russia controls part of the country of Moldova and has a military base there as well. And Putin has been working tirelessly to weaken Moldova's pro-Western government. Last month, Moldovan police found that Russia carried out an unprecedented vote-buying scheme. The Russians spent about $15 million to buy votes for a pro-Russia party in the country. So Putin is just doing everything he can to fix the vote for the head of state, which is coming up on Sunday. So we'll have to see how it goes over the weekend. But even if Putin doesn't manage to win this particular election, it's clear that thanks to all of his money and other efforts, his power over Moldova is growing. And then the last former Soviet nation that I wanted to mention is Belarus. Belarus is already, really, you could call it an unofficial Russian colony. But this week, their leader, Alexander Lukashenko, said that any attempt by Russia to officially annex Belarus would mean war. So these are big words from Lukashenko, but you have to wonder how much say Lukashenko would really have if Putin decided that having Belarus as an unofficial colony was no longer good enough. And if he wanted Belarus to become, you know, an official part of Russia. Lukashenko has been stalling on a formal integration deal for almost 25 years now. So he is shrewd at delaying this. But Putin is really the only reason why Lukashenko is still in power. His people, Lukashenko's people, voted him out years ago. But Putin helped him to remain in office. So because of that, Putin has basically total control over Lukashenko and over Belarus, and probably at this point has no real reason for wanting to make it an official part of Russia. I think the status quo probably serves him very well. That would just be a formality at this point. So I think this was just some bluster by Lukashenko, something that he could try to sell to his people. And it doesn't change the fact that Belarus is now a Russian colony. So there we go, four different former Soviet nations, and Putin is working hard to recapture them all. And this week, we see that he's having some notable successes.
I think any one of those, especially the Georgia one and the Ukraine, you know, several of these could have been a leading story for this whole program, even if they just happened by themselves. These are all really significant developments as he kind of pursues his dream of rebuilding the Soviet Union. I haven't seen many of these stories make much of a splash in the press. I mean, maybe for me, the Georgia one, because I tend to keep an eye on the European press, and they have been more on that story because Georgia was moving towards a European orbit, and now it's kind of being very quickly yanked away from that. The American press is too occupied with the US election to pay much attention. I think we see this a lot from Vladimir Putin, where he does have some pretty eye-catching setbacks every now and again. Like, you think about some of the color revolutions that have happened over the years. 2014 was it when Ukraine was kind of pulled away from his puppet. The fact that his invasion of Ukraine wasn't over in a matter of weeks, didn't go as smoothly as he thought. But he just keeps on going, keeps on pushing over a period of time. And it seems like however many catastrophic reversals he might have in a moment, he wins it back by just patient work. And I think we see several examples of that here.
He is remarkably resilient. He is a survivor, and he is, you know, astoundingly persistent. And the trumpet has been saying since the start of the war, more than 2.5 years ago, that whatever happens, Putin will remain in power and actually become even more powerful. And that has been our stance, because Ezekiel chapter 38 talks about an individual in the modern era. The New King James Version of the Bible describes this man as the prince of Rosh, Meshach, and Tubal. And trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has written quite a lot about this individual over the years. And he says that Rosh, in this passage, should be read as a variation of the name Russia. And he says the other two names signify the Russian cities of Moscow and Tobolsk. In his booklet, The Prophesied Prince of Russia, Mr. Fleury says that it's clear to him that this is describing Vladimir Putin. And he says that the way this is written, with those different names for different parts of Russia described, it shows that Putin would go on to conquer more of the former Soviet territory. He writes, "The reference to the cities of Moscow and Tobolsk helps us to see how vast Russian territory is in these latter days. This giant swath of land indicates the prince will probably conquer more nations of the former Soviet Union." End quote. So this booklet was written way back in 2017, well before Russia's current full-scale invasion of Ukraine was underway, and before some of these other measures that are now happening in Georgia, Moldova, and Belarus were happening. And now we see Russia making gains in all of these former Soviet nations. And if anyone would like to understand these developments in that context, I hope you'll order a free copy of that booklet, The Prophesied Prince of Russia.
It really is a remarkable example of fulfilled prophecy where, you know, based on those words, Stefani made that prediction, and we see that steady push exactly there to rebuild the Soviet Union. Well, I think you've got a couple of other stories as well that from Asia that also ties directly into Bible prophecy.
That's right. Yes. First, a quick China story here. The Chinese are aggressively expanding their nuclear arsenal. That's according to a new report that was just published by the Defense Intelligence Agency. It says the Chinese have already built 500 nuclear warheads and is now, quote, undergoing the most rapid expansion and ambitious modernization of its nuclear forces in history, end quote. So China is still considerably behind Russia's, I think it's 5,500 nuclear weapons, and it's behind America's 3,700, but they are narrowing the gap. And the Chinese are dead set on having a nuclear arsenal that can rival anyone's. So we know that the stakes really could not be higher with these unfathomably destructive weapons. And it's very sobering to see China aggressively building more and more of them as it prepares for war. Then another quick story here about India helping the Russian war effort. A bombshell report was published on Sunday showing that one of India's major pharmaceutical companies is sending Russia millions of dollars worth of servers that include advanced NVIDIA AI processors. These servers and the NVIDIA chips that they contain, they have been restricted by the United States and by the European Union. You know, the US and Europe, they've banned the nations of the world from sending Russia all kinds of militarily useful items, just as a means of trying to weaken Russia's ability to fight against Ukraine. And that includes these kinds of advanced AI chips. But India clearly doesn't care about this US and European ban. And it is sending significant quantities of these to Russia every month, just helping the Russian war machine to keep on humming. So this is really just the latest item of evidence showing that despite India's efforts to look like kind of a US partner and maybe a friend of the West, it is increasingly an ally of Russia.
Well, thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. I wanted to talk about a story. You know, that one, what we've heard has been a bit underreported, several of those. This is one that I think has been massively underreported. And that is a new defense agreement that was signed on October 23rd between the British and German defense secretaries. This agreement now means you will have German planes flying from British bases. You will have the British Army and the German Army working together more closely than ever before. You will have German defense companies playing a much bigger role in Britain's defense manufacturing. The agreement that they signed, it's called the Trinity House Agreement. They signed it at the headquarters for Britain's Lighthouse Service, or England and Wales's Lighthouse Service, because this is meant to be a beacon of how Britain wants to conduct its military policy in the future. Our UK government press release says it marks a fundamental shift in the UK's relations with Germany and for European security. I like the way Politico put it. They took a little more poetic license. They said the British military of the future is going to have a strong German accent. So the British and German armies will train together to fight in Eastern Europe and in the Baltic. At sea, they're going to work together to protect electric and internet cables under the North Sea. German P-87 Poseidon reconnaissance planes will patrol the North Atlantic from Scottish bases. So that's the German planes using British bases that I mentioned. Our two countries were going to work on new long-range strike missiles that can fly further and strike more precisely. These are missiles that will be launched by planes and by ships. We're going to develop new drones for use on land, more unmanned ground vehicles for driving on land, ocean-going drones or drones used to be launched from ships. We're going to help Germany upgrade its helicopters with new missile technology, and then those helicopters will be passed on to Ukraine. Rheinmetall, this German defense giant that's really been increasing in strength and power over the last couple of years, they'll be opening a new factory in the UK, making artillery gun barrels. The German military startup Helsing, this is an AI military startup. I think that's a fascinating. You see startups in AI all over Silicon Valley, but this one is focused solely on the military. It's from Germany. They promised to develop almost half a billion US dollars to develop artificial intelligence systems in the UK. And then Britain and Germany, we're going to work with others to connect our air defense systems to detect long-range missiles. And then Germany's committed to continue to manufacture its Boxer armored personnel carrier in the UK. And all of this relationship will be overseen by a new level of committees designed to manage and improve the Anglo-German relations. I think something else that shows how big of a priority this was for the British government is that Germany was the first destination for Sir Keir Starmer to travel when he became prime minister. And that was when this Trinity House agreement really got started, when it made that trip. It also, it's called a Trinity House agreement. It completes a trinity of bilateral deals. So Britain and France have an agreement called the Lancaster House Agreements. Germany and France have an agreement called the Aachen Treaty. Now with this Trinity House Agreement, it kind of completes this triple entente between these three, where all have bilateral deals. It effectively creates a new alliance that's being called the European Three, or the E3. And this is Britain and Germany, we're NATO allies. We fought alongside each other in conflicts like Afghanistan or in the Balkans. But these two have never had this kind of defense cooperation agreement. So it's a big deal, and it's entirely uncontroversial. It was barely covered at all in the British media. The only piece of criticism I saw of this deal came from a Conservative MP complaining that the Labour Party were taking credit for negotiations that he did, and that actually part of this deal, he got started, and it didn't have anything to do with what Labour did. Nobody cares, really, in Britain. Britain trusts Germany so much that this increased military cooperation barely makes the news. I mean, just in 2016, fears of the creation of a European army or some kind of European defence union, they played into Britain voting for Brexit. But just 8 years later, I mean, we're being sucked back into something that would be at the heart and core of a European military. And we don't really seem bothered about it.
I think it's interesting with when you look at, say, some of the perspectives and predictions, the predecessor or the editor-in-chief of our predecessor, Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong, The Plain Truth, when he was alive and going through Europe right after World War II and Germany lay in rubble and Britain was one of the victorious allies, was one of the governing powers with troops on the ground in Germany when decades later West Berlin still had a British sector. He was saying that Germany was going to rise from the ashes and dominate Europe again. It's that when he made those predictions, it's still within living memory. And now you have German Air Force at this point stationed in Britain. Before, not that long ago, even like with West Berlin, it was a few decades ago, you had Britain stationed in Germany, and now you have Germany stationed in Britain. And as you said, it's uncontroversial, even though, never mind people worrying about circumstances at a vote, like even though within living memory the two countries were at war with each other, I think that says a lot.
Yeah, I think that is a great point, and it shows so much about German resurgence. I just looked it up. Britain's last military base was handed back to Germany in 2020. So it was just 4 years ago, though I think there's still a British military presence at some NATO bases within Germany. But I mean, that's part of the reason why Sir Keir Starmer went to Germany right away. He wanted to rebuild relations with Europe. He knew that to do that, you go to Berlin. And when I saw this story, it reminded me of an article Mr. Flurry, Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry, wrote in 1999 called Alamogordo, A Mistake You Only Make Once. Because this was about when the US allowed Germany to establish the first permanent foreign military base in America. This was at the Holloman Air Force Base in New Mexico, which they've now pulled out of. But you still had, and you had Germany, the US chief of staff of its European forces was a German military officer. You have this same level of put planes on our bases, trust from America. And he was making the same point that, well, this is entirely uncontroversial. And in that article, he had a quote from Winston Churchill's book, World Crisis. It was the first time I'd read this quote. And it really, really hit me or stood out to me. I thought it was just very profound, where he's talking about the world in the lead up to World War One, and he's talking about all the people in the run up to World War One who said, we won't have another war, we won't have a surprise strike, you know, nothing like this is going to happen. And the reasonings they gave are the same reasons people give today. You know, they said, he said, no, it is nothing. No one would do such things. Civilization has climbed above such perils. The interdependence of nations and trade and traffic, the sense of public law, the Hague Convention, liberal principles, the Labour Party, high finance, Christian charity, common sense have rendered such nightmares impossible. And Churchill writes, are you sure? It would be a pity to be wrong. Such a mistake could only be made once, once for all. And we have the same mentality today. I think many, you know, many believe we've climbed above such perils of all-out war. I think perhaps many more believe, okay, yeah, we could have war. We're not beyond war. But such a war would come from like a rogue state like Iran, or it would come from someone who's very kind of obviously bent on conquest, like Vladimir Putin and his vision to rebuild the Soviet Union, or a rising rival superpower to the United States like China. You know, that's where war might come from. But that for a country to be a friend and ally and then turn on us, to turn on Britain or to turn on America, well, no, that is not. No one would do such things. That is kind of regarded as unthinkable. And history warns us not to be so dismissive. Other nations in the past have been caught napping. Like, that happens in history. And Mr. Flurry's article, Alamogordo, A Mistake You Only Make Once, and he goes through several examples of Germany doing exactly that, making these kind of surprise moves. And I think you see this, you know, I think it's interesting to see this, not just in context of that British news, but a lot of the news that you had while we're off air. I think one of the other ones is you had Germany inaugurating a new multinational naval headquarters in Rostock. I mean, this is a, like, I don't, from what I've seen, nobody really asked Germany to do this. They've been building this new naval headquarters. You've had some people in Eastern Europe and news out of Poland and things kind of saying like, yeah, like we're not really that keen on having Germany run the Baltic Navy. They want to and run NATO's Navy for the, but they're just kind of doing it. They're building the headquarters. They're taking over leadership of the of NATO's Baltic Navy. And so this headquarters is going to be a new command task force Baltic headquarters. A German admiral is going to run it. There'll be staff from 11 other NATO countries. I mean, they're taking on more of these roles, commanding other people's militaries and stationing their soldiers. They're building their first permanent military base in Lithuania. And nobody's really worried. Outside of some of those, say some few in Eastern Europe and Poland. But the Bible gives us even more specific warnings. In Ezekiel 23:22, God tells Britain and America, I will raise up your lovers against you. You know, those people, those nations that you think really love you and will fight to defend you, I'm raising them up against you. Hosea chapter 5 and verse 13 is a warning that I think, yeah, and it's probably going to connect to what you, Mihaila, are about to talk about with the Middle East, because this talks about, Hosea 5 talks about both Ephraim, that's Britain in modern day Bible prophecy, but then also Judah, the Jews in the Middle East. And he says there when it says there when Ephraim saw his sickness and Judah saw his wound, then went Ephraim to the Assyrian and sent to King Jareb. Now, this refers to Britain and then also Judah in the Middle East. Both turn to Assyria. They turn to modern day Germany for help with their critical problems. And as that passage goes on to describe, and other parts of Hosea describe, they're betrayed. They think they're getting help, and Germany turns against them. I mean, you can watch for that to happen as Israel tries to grapple with this issue of, well, what do we do long run in Lebanon and in Gaza? And we see Britain doing the same thing at the same time. And our free book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, that is your guide, your essential guide to Bible prophecy and what God is doing in the world. And I've just been going over just yesterday the first chapter of that. And it really struck me just the way Mr. Armstrong sets this whole book up in the big picture of understanding the problems of the world. Why world events are the way they are. Why our nations have the problems the way they do. Why we can't solve issues of war and peace. And if there's a loving God overseeing all of that, what is he doing about a world that can't solve war and peace? And that can't understand cause and effect, and that isn't able to solve its problems. Well, that book tells you. And that book is about not God's love for Britain and the United States, but God's love for the whole world. And really, that book is about some more direct punishment that is coming upon Britain and America and on Judah in the Middle East, because those nations have had a history and an opportunity to know God and his law that other nations haven't. But it's about what God is doing for the entire planet and how he wants to, how he is working with the entire planet and how it's going to lead to the entire planet having an invitation to come into God's family. So that's that book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. All of the material we'll leave in the show notes. You can go to our website, thetrumpet.com, and you can read it online. Or even better, you can get your own free print copy so you can study it alongside your Bible and look at it there. Well, I'd wanted to quickly cover a few other important stories from Europe. We've seen quite a few stories about Europe getting more involved in the Middle East. And again, I think this is going to overlap with what we'll talk about with Mihailo shortly. So it's not just Germany making friends and signing deals with Britain. He's the German Chancellor, Olaf Scholz. He visited Turkey on October 19th. He visited the Turkish President, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. And he talked about how they needed to cooperate much more closely. He approved millions worth of arms exports to Turkey. Watch for them to do that as they move into the Middle East. France was being very involved, was trying to get more involved with Lebanon. They recently held a big fundraising event where they invited a whole lot of nations into Paris and tried to raise funds for Lebanon. Lebanon, of course, used to be a French colony. Watch for them to really push themselves to be more involved with what the day after looks like for Lebanon. And then Germany has been talking about that as well. Germany is a contributor to the naval part of the United Nations interim force in Lebanon. So that's an important story to watch. Iran is giving Germany another reason to get involved in the Middle East and to confront Iran. So Iran executed a German citizen on Monday. That really got the attention of the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz. He called this German citizen's execution a scandal. He was a dual German-Iranian citizen that was basically kidnapped from the United Arab Emirates. German Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock, she promised serious consequences. I don't know whether they'll materialize. Maybe it will just be a strongly worded letter. But you certainly see Iran is not afraid to keep pushing at Europe and pushing at Germany. And eventually they will respond. And then Britain, we just saw our biggest ever tax rise yesterday. The Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, and his Chancellor, they just put up taxes, the largest amount ever, at least when it comes to monetary amounts. It's pretty cowardly. They're working to hide it as much as possible. So the biggest increase was on the increase that the taxes that businesses pay based on an employee's salary. So it's called the employer's contribution. They have to pay a tax. As an employee, you know, I don't even see that on my paycheck. It's not there as part of the tax that I pay to the government. So it's still a payroll tax that businesses pay. So in doing that, I don't immediately lose money out of my paycheck, but I do become more expensive to hire for my employer. So what that means across the country is going to be less pay rises, maybe pay cuts, more costs for businesses that could be passed on to consumers in the form of inflation and higher prices. The government's admitted, yes, this is going to suppress pay for private sector workers. Meanwhile, the government is handing out record pay rises to public sector workers as they hold the nation hostage with strikes. So we're seeing a big transfer of wealth from the private sector to the public sector, and a public sector that, despite the invention of things like the internet, has not increased in efficiency and productivity barely at all since the 90s. Something that's phenomenally inefficient. So this is more decline for the nation, more wasted economic resources. And then a massive story from Britain that we talked about on Wednesday's show was that UK government was found lying about the Southport attacks. So this is where a terrorist went and stabbed three little girls at around 6, 7, and 9 at a dance workshop, horrified the nation. People were being jailed for saying that this was a Muslim terrorist attack. And then the government comes out now, a month later, charging the person that did it with terrorism offenses and announcing that they knew all along that he had an Al-Qaeda training manual. Shocking level of injustice, shocking level of censorship, of lying. It shows our government is corrupt. I talk about that on Wednesday's show as well. we're getting punishments. Our nations are being cursed. Some of that involves its leadership. But again, the United States and Britain in Prophecy explains why, and it explains the hope for Britain, for America, and for the whole world, and for the Middle East, which brings us over to Mihailo. There is a big false hope that is being widely touted right now that we might finally have peace in the Middle East, as Hezbollah and Israel are reportedly on the brink of a peace deal. What can you tell us about that?
Yes, well, some context. Since Israel had assassinated Hassan Nasrallah, the Hezbollah's leader, and everybody else basically around him, Hezbollah's been officially and unofficially leaderless. But on Tuesday, they finally inaugurated their new Secretary General, Naim Qassem, who has been Nasrallah's deputy since he's been in office. Nasrallah's been in office even before that. He had the job since 1991 under Nasrallah's predecessor, Abbas al-Mousawi. Apparently he was gunning for the top job and never got it, so now it's his chance now that he's in his 70s.
Because Israel's been gunning harder for the top job.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's a bit interesting that Israel let him live this long, even though he was Hezbollah's number two and basically everybody around him had survived. Yoav Gallant, Israel's defense minister, for his part, tweeted after the announcement was made, quote, temporary appointment, not for long.
Yeah, we should add at time of recording for all of this, yes, just in case he gets assassinated before this is released, which is not actually unlikely.
Yeah, exactly. But all these circumstances, I think, maybe are playing in his head. And it was apparent on Wednesday when he gave his first speech as Hezbollah's new leader. And he talked about a lot of things, but here's a clip we'll play that caught at least enough analysts' eyes.
If the Israelis decide they want to stop the aggression, we say we accept, but under the conditions that we see as appropriate and suitable. We will not beg for a ceasefire. We're continuing, and we're not waiting, no matter how long it takes. There is no result, because so far, no project has been proposed that Israel agrees to and that we can discuss.
So that was, again, him speaking, and as you could hear, it sounded like he wanted to do a ceasefire. Hezbollah, since the war started, has always talked about doing a ceasefire, but they still kept firing rockets, and they still wouldn't live up to the obligations that Israel and much of the international community wanted them to live up to. Why is this different? Well, for one thing, a lot of people picked up when he made that statement and throughout his whole speech, he never mentioned that Hezbollah stopping their guns from firing is conditional on Israel stopping its war in Gaza. That has been the number one condition Nasrallah has been putting on Israel, and Qassem left it out. And the silence, I guess you could say, is deafening in that case. But it's a lot more than just what he didn't say or what he did say. There are tangible pieces of evidence coming out that media are reporting on that something is really, really close. For one thing, apparently a draft agreement of a U.S.-designed ceasefire deal has been leaked to the Israeli media. It supposedly has been drafted by Amos Hochstein, which is Joe Biden's special envoy to the region with what's going on in Lebanon. And the Jerusalem Post reported that they got a look at the document, and they, according to what they saw, the provisions include evicting Hezbollah from south of Lebanon's Litani River, which, if anybody's been paying attention to the news since 2012, that was supposed to be what Hezbollah was supposed to do since the last time they fought Israel in a war, according to a UN resolution, Resolution 1701. And now it takes Israel being on the ground, decapitating the leadership, for Hezbollah to finally say, okay, we're actually are going north of the Litani River and not coming out. And apparently Hezbollah has spoken to Lebanese media confirming that they're agreeing to that provision. And just as a interesting little aside, the Litani River is actually named after the Canaanite name of Leviathan, the biblical monstrous creature. But anyway, other provisions include that Israel would have to cease offensive operations within Lebanon and leave Lebanon within a week of the deal being signed. Now, that might sound like Israel's backpedaling a little bit, that they're losing ground, but at this point, Israel's basically fulfilled all the objectives they wanted, and then some. Yoav Gallant recently said that about 80% of Hezbollah's military capability pre-October 7th has now been destroyed. There's been report after report about the IDF coming in and destroying all these Hezbollah tunnel compounds, these weapon caches on the southern border. As we mentioned, Hezbollah has basically been decapitated and humiliated, really, in the Middle East, in the Islamic world, within Lebanon itself, and the whole world. In essence, I don't want to call them a paper tiger, because they did definitely have a lot of potential to do some damage, but they just never used it for whatever reason. There's a lot of evidence suggesting that they would have only intervened if they got the green light from Iran, that Iran would have their back, and Iran never gave that, which put them in a bit of a bind. But even speaking of Hochstein, the Lebanese Prime Minister Najib Mikati, the actual supposedly the leader of the country of Lebanon, even though he doesn't really have a say in anything that's going on now. But here's a quote he gave regarding American mediation. Quote, Hochstein, during his call with me, suggested to me that we could reach an agreement before the end of the month and before November 5th. Interesting date. I wonder why they said that. Anyway, continuing, we are doing everything we can, and we should remain optimistic that in the coming hours or days, we will have a ceasefire, end quote. Now, in the notoriously volatile region of the Middle East, even saying things like this could derail potential agreements and a lot of potentially big deals between countries like Israel and, say, Arab countries have been derailed because people have prematurely said what was happening. The fact that Mikati has been able to say this publicly suggests that there is tangible results coming from this. And by the time this episode airs, maybe all of this will be out of date. As he said, he mentioned hours potentially, but at least at the time of recording, that seems to be the situation on the ground. One more interesting, I guess you could say, inclusion of what this ceasefire deal may include. Al-Akbar, Hezbollah's affiliated newspaper, supposedly claimed that Hezbollah demanded that Germany leave UNIFIL. That's the United Nations source there in southern Lebanon. Ostensibly because for being a, quote, accomplice of the enemy, probably to do with that German frigate associated with UNIFIL shooting down a Hezbollah projectile earlier in October. I think it's interesting that, I mean, there's a lot of countries in UNIFIL. Britain's in UNIFIL. Britain's been helping out Israel, I'd say, a lot more than Germany with, say, shooting down Iran's projectiles or the Houthis projectiles. But this one incident is apparently enough of an excuse for Hezbollah to single out Germany and everything they're doing. And even from the stuff Nasrallah has said before when he was alive, from stuff Germany has said regarding Hezbollah, it looks like both Germany and Hezbollah, one way or another, have each other on their respective radars.
This is an important point. It's something we'll have more on as we work to get our upcoming Trumpet print out the door and over to you. We should have, hopefully, a pretty beefy article from Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry on some of what's happening in Lebanon and Europe's efforts to get involved. And he's really focused on that because of several key Bible prophecies.
Yes. The main one that I guess you could say is the linchpin of what we're watching for is in Psalm 83, verses 6 through 8, which talk about Asher, the ancestral people of the Germans, allying with certain Middle Eastern peoples, including Gebal and Tyre, which are cities in Lebanon to this day. If you look at all the different peoples included in the alliance, they never appear either as allied with each other like this or for the particular purposes the psalm reveals. That's why Mr. Flurry has pointed to this being a prophecy. And you combine that with other prophecies like Daniel 11, which talk about Germany and United Europe under a different name, the King of the North, clashing with a King of the South, which Mr. Flurry has identified being Iran and its allies, its radical Islamist allies. You put those two together and you see that Germany and Iran are going to be against each other, and whoever's mentioned in Psalm 83 one way or another is going to be allied with Germany instead of Iran at some point soon. Lebanon is included with this, even though Hezbollah is arguably Iran's biggest lapdog in the region. They are basically a carbon copy of the Iranian Revolution to bring the Iranian Revolution to Lebanon. Well, because of this, Mr. Flurry has predicted that Hezbollah, or one way or another, Iran's control of the country is going to be removed from Lebanon. this latest escalation in the region and with the war is probably the most straightforward, clearest way for that to happen. We've already seen major developments in just Israel decapitating all the leadership, neutralizing Hezbollah as a serious threat that makes them more vulnerable than ever. How exactly Iran will leave is the details still remain to be seen. There's still a lot of dust to settle in the region, but with how desperate you see Hezbollah wanting a ceasefire. I mean, terror groups don't ask for a ceasefire and don't suggest they give up so much unless they know the writing is on the wall for them. So Hezbollah itself sees that it is in a very bad place. And for Israel to agree to it, or to at least keep negotiations going, suggests that, yeah, they see Hezbollah is in a bad place as well, that they will come out stronger out of this. And again, as I mentioned, as you mentioned earlier in your segment, you're seeing Germany brought more and more involved into this. But everything that we've been talking about has been really synergizing into this one arena. And we can definitely expect these trends to escalate as circumstances move forward. If people would like to learn more about this, we have an article in the latest Trumpet edition, the November-December one, called Hezbollah's Days Are Numbered, which can give a little context on why we watch Lebanon and what we expect in the near future.
Well, that would be a great spot on which to end, but I think there are a few other important news stories that you have for us, Mihailo.
On last Monday, however, the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, outlawed the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, or more commonly known under its acronym UNRWA, from operating within the country, as well as, of course, the Palestinian territories. It'll take a few days for that to take effect, but if anybody's been paying attention to the mainstream media, you'd think that Israel's just declared war.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of pearl clutching.
Yeah, exactly, that Israel's just declared war on the United Nations. In actual fact, the United Nations declared war on Israel, almost literally, because a lot of UNRWA employees participated on October 7th. Even Ismail Haniyeh, the former leader of Hamas, used to work for UNRWA. They're still being used as a vehicle to help Hamas out surreptitiously. We have an article from April of this year, the print edition, called Hamas Made in the United Nations, that can examine a little bit more what UNRWA is and why it's such a danger for Israel. Also on October 25th, the Wall Street Journal published an article citing European officials claiming that Russia is sending satellite data to the Houthi rebels in Yemen via Iran to, I guess, help them out with their target practice a little bit, which, and this has apparently been going on for months now. No surprise that Russia is trying to poke at the West wherever it can, but the fact that it's actively helping out the Houthis, which, I mean, are about as undesirable as even terror groups can get, shows just how committed they are to attacking the West. One thing we watch for at the Trumpet is Iran and its proxies gaining control of maritime choke points and important trade routes. But we also, because of other prophecies in places like Isaiah 23, we expect other adversaries like China, like Russia, to take a notice at these trade routes and try to get control over them as well. China is the main country we expect to be pushing that, but I mean, Russia, as other passages bring out, will be tied up in there as well. And I suspect Putin's looking at some of the damage the Houthis are causing, or that Iran is saber rattling in other areas. And I think he's starting to get a few ideas just on how to hurt the West through taking advantage of these trade routes. And we have a trends article on our website called Why the Trumpet Watches the Development of a Massive Anti-American Trade Bloc. It's a bit of a mouthful, I'll repeat it. Why the Trumpet Watches the Development of a Massive Anti-American Trade Bloc, that goes through what exactly you're watching for. And ultimately, as the former host of our radio program, Mr. Philip Nice, used to say, why it's going to affect everybody when everything that around you usually comes through a port. So this is not just talking about geopolitics and numbers on a spreadsheet. This directly affects daily life for people all over the world, including most likely whoever is listening to this program. So it's a pretty important trend to watch for, and we expect it to grow in the coming days.
Thank you for that, Mihailo. And it is remarkable to see. We talked about this a bit on Wednesday's show as well. This transformation in the Middle East along the clear lines of Bible prophecy. Like, this is not just random chaos that you're seeing here. We said that, and Mr. Flurry said, that Hezbollah would be defeated or Lebanon would be freed from Hezbollah. That's exactly what we're seeing based on that Psalm 83 prophecy. But then we've also talked about, yeah, well, Israel is going to trust in Germany. The Psalm 80, that same prophecy in Psalm 83 talks about all these different Arab countries and Germany making crafty counsels, deceiving Israel. And even now, as the war draws to a close and Israel's shown a lot of strength, there's signs that they're looking to these other Arab countries and to Europe to come in and form the lasting peace deal. I think it was just today or yesterday, Benjamin Netanyahu was saying there'll be more peace deals with more Arab countries. We're going to see more kind of these Abraham Accords, which do bring Israel some temporary benefits. But Israel more and more is trusting in all of these countries around them, which the Bible said they would do. And the Bible says that they're going to be betrayed. I mean, we're seeing the Middle East events unfold exactly according to Bible prophecy. And that really is the message of the show. What you're seeing all around you is not random events. It's not random chaos and different things bouncing off each other and stuff just happening. We're telling you that God rules in the kingdom of men, that he has a plan. That yes, human beings do have free will and free agency, but ultimately, everything happens within the overall framework of God's plan for mankind. And he's making that work out because he loves all of mankind and he is going to open up his family to all of mankind. The world as a whole is deceived and cut off from God, but it's not going to stay that way. And we're living in the very last days of this present evil world, and we're going to see some wonderful days in the future. So I think that's a great spot on which to end. Thank you so much for our panelists. It's great to be back in our regular format with even taking a bit of time off and then traveling a little before then. We've not all been around the virtual table together for a while. It's great to be back and in that format. Thank you very much to George Haddad and Isaac Lorenz for engineering and production. Thank you so much for you, the listener, for bearing with us while we're away, tuning back in again. Coming to us, whether you're watching on Rumble or YouTube or listening over the air in the Edmond, Oklahoma region on 101.3 on the FM dial on KPCG, or whether you're downloading the podcast. However it is, we're very happy to have you. You can get in touch with us, trumpetworld@thetrumpet.com. You can go to The Trumpet and order the material that we have offered. We'll be back with another show on Wednesday. And until then, keep watching your world.